I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday at the Movies.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
At the Cannes Film Festival next month, movies from streaming services like Netflix and Amazon won't be allowed to compete unless they're released in French theaters for a month before they become available online. Is a movie if you can watch it on your phone? Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post, join me. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews La Llorona at the Cohesion Theater. That's all coming up right after the news. And good afternoon, everybody. It's Midday at the Movies. I'm Tom Hall. I'm glad you're with us on this sunny afternoon. Jed Dietz, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival, joins us as always. Good to see you, sir.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And always. Making a rare cameo appearance, ladies and gentlemen, Anne Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post. Good to see you, Anne.
It's good to be seen, Tom.
Indeed. So you weren't here in January.
I know.
You showed up in February.
I know.
You weren't here in March. And by the way, we're delighted that Max Weiss from Baltimore Magazine filled
the best.
In. She's terrific.
She's great.
And you're here in April. So the Vegas bookies are wondering, are you going to be here for the May edition of Midnight?
Bobbing and weaving, baby.
That's it.
You guessing.
You were doing speaking engagements.
I had a couple of speaking engagements along the way, which is always fun.
Jed and I don't have that problem because
yes,
people. No, we don't, because people never ask us to speak because they already think we talk too much anyway.
You're men of the people. You're men of the. They want your wisdom.
But as her agent, though, I want to point out this is co-starring. This is not a cameo.
That's right. It's not a cameo.
Okay,
a co-starring.
Right.
But you know, every day, but 2 minutes to 12, like clockwork, our director and engineer Luke Spicknell looks at me, and he says, "We're about to start. Are you going to talk again?" And I say, "Yeah." And he just shakes his head. He bows it and he pushes the button. And then it all just transpires.
Oh, I love it.
Anyway, so you wrote, Anne, a very interesting piece in the Washington Post about this conflict that's going on at the Cannes Film Festival. We've mentioned it before, but it seems to have heated up a little bit.
Yeah.
And Cannes has decided officially to no longer allow films to compete in the festival unless if they're on streaming services, Netflix, Amazon, that kind of stuff, unless they've been in French movie theaters for a month before they are available online.
Right. That's or weird. Promised to be.
Or promised to be. So what's that all about? That's
interesting. Well, this got started last year when actually, it started a couple of years before that when Amazon made a huge incursion into Cannes. I mean, they had like four or five movies at Cannes 1 year, which was a real watershed, you know, for a streaming service to have that many films of quality playing at Cannes, the premier film festival of the world. It just sent a signal that Amazon was serious about films. Now, of course, Amazon's strategy is to release its movies in theaters before making them available on streaming. And so that endears them to the purists in the film world who really want to preserve that theatrical experience. Netflix is not nearly as nice. You know, they're all about day and date. You know, they want to put their stuff up when they want to put it up. They don't care about theatrical. They give their movies nominal theatrical releases only to qualify for awards, usually day and date with when they make their things available with streaming, which is very much to the consternation, obviously, of theater owners.
So day and date means if it's in the theaters, it's also you can get it in Netflix. Yeah,
correct. So last year, Netflix did have two movies in competition. They had Okja, the Korean film, and the Meyerowitz Stories. A charming movie by Noah Baumbach that I wish had gotten more attention. But those were in competition. And I think Terry Fermeau, who's the director of Cannes, I think his thinking was it was immediately critiqued by French theater owners. How dare you? Sacre bleu, you know, they're eating into our business and what are you doing to us? And I think his argument was, we will convince Netflix, you know, of the wisdom of opening in theatrical. And that was never going to happen. It was his own, I think his own kind of maybe inflated sense of Cannes' relevance to a company like Netflix. At any rate, he did come through this year with that statement that no longer will those movies be, but they will be welcome to play in sidebars and you know, they have lots of different programs.
So they'll be screened. Yeah. They just won't compete for the Palme d'Or.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, it's an interesting notion now because the business is changing. I mean, even more radically than when we talked about it the last time, which was several months ago. I mean, Netflix is a gigantic player in the movie business now.
Yeah, they're the biggest in terms of just production budgets. And they, you know, it's so important to remember 6 years ago, they had not made one movie before they did House of Cards. And they had bought one, but they hadn't made one. And it's phenomenal that in this short period of time, they've become the biggest producer of movie product, or however you want to call the episodic stuff and all that combined. And I think the French are right in this case, and maybe they didn't say it right. And I think Anne's right. It's not going to have, you know, Netflix is Netflix. They are going to, their main thing is streaming. But I think they could embrace the theatrical in a way that would be very helpful to them in streaming.
It's an interesting strategy that Netflix doesn't want to be in theaters. I guess they think it eats into the people streaming.
I don't think they thought it out that much. I think it's literally they want it for their service. And of course, that's right. I get that. The thing that I think they're missing is you can do both, and you can, you know, really embrace this art form that should be seen, or I would say always should be seen, in a group in a movie theater. Although I love the streaming services, and we're delighted for the most of the submissions we get to the festival now are streaming, you know, with password protected links and stuff. That's completely new. I mean, that, you know, 10 years ago that was never happening. We were getting DVDs or tapes in the mail.
Yeah,
And I think it's great for movie going and great for filmmakers.
But this really has divided the film community. Sort of the so-called purists on the one hand saying movies are movies. That means it's in a theater. And then you have these others saying, you know, I mean, because interesting, we used to use the term TV movie,
mm-hmm. right?
A movie made for TV,
right. which is almost like an oxymoron.
Which is what Steven Spielberg wants to call it. He also got into this fray when he was doing publicity for Ready Player One. But I do think, you know, Netflix did make a small allowance for Mudbound. They did open that movie in more than the usual theaters that they would do.
Yep.
And that did end up getting nominated for Academy Awards, which told me, okay, you know, there's like a little wiggle room here that's interesting to explore. But then they, you know, at the same time, they're dropping Cloverfield on Super Bowl Sunday making it a huge event, completely, you know, disproportionate to the quality of the film. And I feel that their sense is, why are we spending money sending stuff into theaters with the commensurate advertising and marketing budget that goes along with it, when we can make an event out of a subpar property like a Cloverfield and, you know, do pretty well with it? And the same could be said about that Will Smith movie that they did, Bright. So what I would like to see is them eventizing a Mudbound more, you know, like make that, like, I mean, I feel like they kind of did the traditional thing with Mudbound, which was nice. But I like you said, I think they're still, I'd like to see them get a little more creative about what they consider an event.
And I think they will, because I think they'll learn that they'll benefit from it, and it'll be good for everybody, all the consumers.
Well, I love, you know, the terminology among the aficionados. I mean, Anne, you wrote a book, right, called Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies.
Yeah,
and there's even some consternation about the term movies.
Yeah.
I mean, you quote Spielberg at the Southwest Festival,
right,
who's talking about his latest thing, which is a virtual reality thing called Ready Player One. And he says, this is not a film that we've made. This is, I promise you, a movie. Right. It's like, what's the difference between a film and a movie? Is a commercial a mini movie? You know, is a posting on YouTube a mini movie? The film idiom now, what is there? Do you make a distinction, Jed, between a film and a movie? Is one commercial and one artsy, or is there a difference? It's like choir and chorus. What's the difference? People used to ask me that all the time. The answer I had, zero.
Yeah, we use film and movie completely interchangeably. I think where you get a little bit queasy is when it's made for streaming or made for television, and then you show it in a movie theater like, what is that?
But documentaries do that all the time.
I know. I'm not too interested in the semantics, to be honest with you. That's why we flip back and forth in our world, we flip back and forth all the time between film and movie. So if you're attracted by films, but the movie people won't then be offended by it. It is interesting. There was opening night shorts program back several years ago. There was a very important YouTube posting, arguably the most important film made that year, which disrupted the gubernatorial election in Virginia, and therefore the career of one of the candidates who was being talked about as a Republican front runner for president. And we talked about putting that in our opening night program because of its importance, and we ultimately decided not to because it was not made by a filmmaker. It had no intent to be a movie or a film. It was literally political stalking. But you're asking the right question, and I don't think there's a set answer. I think we're in the middle of figuring that out.
Yeah, and folks, if you're listening and you want to weigh in, we'd love to hear from you. 410-662-8780. When is a movie a movie? If you can watch something on your phone, is it still a movie? Give us a call. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR.
To this point, the Motion Picture Association of America literally yesterday just released its annual survey of movie going, the market trends in movie going, and they included, for the first time, they've included entertainment, home entertainment and streaming, DVD and Blu-ray, all of those, because they count. Those are all, this all kind of feeds into whether something succeeds or not. And the reason why that's important is that when things succeed, Hollywood being slavishly risk averse and imitative will do it again. And so this all matters in terms of what they consider viable, because it affects what we end up seeing or able to see.
And from the customer standpoint, I think the answer should be all of the above. That's my argument.
I mean, like Steve Soderbergh, big Steven Soderbergh, big, huge director who quit the film business, the movie business, whatever. He went into retirement because he was so disgusted with the whole thing. Well, he's back. He's got a movie called Unsane. I think it's currently at the Senator.
Yeah.
It may be on its way out. But he filmed the entire thing, and I use the word film, the verb film, loosely, because he shot it, as we say, on an iPhone.
Right.
So what does that mean? I mean, there are purists who say it ain't a movie unless you shoot it on film stock, right?
Well, and we still, at the Parkway, we're showing 35 millimeter versions of things, and it is fun to see them. I personally think the digital world has gotten so beautifully textured and, that I'm perfectly happy to see a 4K restoration. And there are people who, the 4K restoration, for instance, of Lawrence of Arabia, people will argue very strongly that that's the best restoration, better even than the great 70 millimeter one that we showed the festival years ago.
So what does 4K mean?
It's just a digital measurement. It's a density measurement. And I'm sure there will be 8K and 16K as we go forward.
It's more, would that reflect the visual information that's in that?
Exactly.
As the numbers go up, that's just more information that you're getting. It's a more refined.
Exactly.
Refined image.
And on the Lawrence of Arabia, apparently, literally when David Lean was filming in the desert, the film distorted in the camera. No film print could get that out of there in any restoration. They have apparently been able to get that out. I haven't seen the 4K Lawrence of Arabia, but I hear it's beautiful, and I would love to see it.
Yeah, and of course, a caller who had to leave, couldn't stick on the line, says, don't forget the term picture.
You think
the movie mogul with the cigar, hanging out the right side of his head.
Yeah. We're
making
that
a picture.
A picture.
Well, your book is called Moving Pictures,
right?
How to Watch Movies. Talking Pictures. Yeah, the same thing.
But well, and when the Parkway first opened in 1915 before sound, they called them photo plays.
Aww. Yeah. All right, more on this when we come back. We're going to take a quick break. Ann Hornaday is the film critic for The Washington Post. The book is called Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Jed Dietz is the founder and the director of the Maryland Film Festival. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
And thanks, Matt. It is Midday at the Movies. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's the Midday News Wrap with a focus on the Maryland legislature. Joshua Harris and the Reverend Kobe Little of the NAACP will join me. They'll have an update on the status of Senate Bill 122. That's an omnibus crime bill making its way through the Maryland General Assembly. The NAACP strongly opposes that bill. I'll also check in with WIPR's Annapolis reporter Rachel Bay, who will set the stage for us as the General Assembly enters its final weekend before they recess on Monday night. Plus, internationally acclaimed operatic soprano and director Marquita Lister and Morgan State University opera conductor Lester Green will join me. They've got a preview of a new opera based on the life and loves of the poet Paul Laurence Dunbar. That opera opens at Morgan State this weekend, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. On Midday, coming up later today, a theater review with J. Wynn Russick. If you've just joined us, it's Midday at the Movies with our good buddies Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Ann Hornaday of the Washington Post. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to find us in the Twittersphere at Midday WIPR. So I want to talk about a film that was made for television, for HBO, a film, a movie, a picture, whatever you want to call it. One of the executive producers is a dear friend of the three of us, Taylor Branch, a great historian of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. It's interesting. I saw this movie both on my computer. I got a screener because I was interviewing Taylor about it. And then I also saw it, you and Dennis and Linnell and I sat together at the Parkway Theater last week when it was screened there on the big screen. It's called King in the Wilderness. It concerns Martin Luther King's last 3 years, the 3 years leading up to his assassination in 1968. Let's talk about it as a movie. I talked to Taylor about it in terms of, you know, Dr. King's significance. We had a long conversation about that yesterday. But Jed, as a movie, this is a very powerful piece of film.
It's incredible. And I think largely because it's about a figure most of us think we know quite a bit about. We've grown up, you know, being taught him and observing him, depending on how old we are. And I think by focusing on these 3 years, these last 3 years of his life, the extraordinary thing you see is the humanity and the incredible political skill and the navigational skill of one of the great Americans. And the conflict that's in this movie is the kind of thing, you know, you would try to build into any movie, and this happens to be a movie about real life.
We have a comment from Don in Catonsville who says that a movie is an entertaining story and a film explores the human condition.
Oh,
so he makes a sort of,
okay,
you know, aesthetic judgment. Well, then this, if that's true, if we accept Don's premise, Ann Hornaday, this is a terrific film.
Right. But and I would say a movie because I was gripped and riveted throughout. I mean, I think that the if you want to talk about it formally, the choices that Peter Kunhart, the director, and I'm sure Taylor informed these too as a producer, they made so many astute, judicious choices in terms of how to tell this story. As Taylor said the other night, they decided not to go with a narrator. It's archival footage, extraordinary archival footage that I think a lot of viewers will not have seen before. They'll be really surprised by. And then these witnesses, you know, the colleagues and friends and loved ones of Martin Luther King, and their reminiscences are so intense. You know, it's just a very, it's not rote. You know, there's nothing, it's a really powerful emotional experience. And that doesn't happen automatically. I mean, that's all a function of really how you decide to compose your shots and how you edit them. And you know, it's a real formal challenge to bring this material to life the way they did. And they just did a magnificent job.
Here's an example. Here's Harry Belafonte, a very close friend of Dr. King, thinking about Dr. King.
Martin's moments when the curtain was drawn and he was not on public display was a man who revealed his deepest concerns about his right to do what he was doing. The fact that he was touched by that calling in history disturbed him because he didn't quite understand it. He referred everything to divine intervention, to divine power. It's what God has called on me to do. And in the depth of that belief, that religious commitment, those voices that he heard really existed for him.
Harry Belafonte in King in the Wilderness. It's streaming on HBO, and we can't recommend it highly enough. It is really worth seeking out. Let's go to the phones. Christy in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday. Hi.
Hi. So I live in Hamden in Baltimore, and we have a new movie theater that's really, it's gotten really expensive. It's like a really fancy movie theater. And I like going to the movies, but it's not, it doesn't seem to be as accessible as it used to be. Do we think that's because of the streaming services, and that's why?
Well, that particular movie, you're talking about the one that's in the former Rotunda?
The Rotunda, yep.
Mm-hmm. That's a whole separate deal, Jed, because this is a company that has things all around the country where you get served dinner, and it's like a gourmet dinner, you know, wait service and stuff. So that's a very different thing. It's movies plus, isn't it?
Yeah, and smaller seating capacity, bigger chairs, and actually the two big Cinemark chains in our area, Arundel Mills and Towson, have also rebooted their theaters and put in these big chairs. And I think, you know, this gets back to theater owners who have no control over the product and really don't even curate the product. They're taking whatever they get from the studio and crossing their fingers and hoping it actually works, are just trying to combat the streaming impulse and the stay on your couch and watch on your big screen TV by making the experience even better
in
movie theaters.
But they're charging for it. This is called the Cine Bistro.
Yeah.
I haven't been in there yet.
It's fun. We actually went to see Ready Player One there, and it's, first of all, to a person, the people that worked there were utterly delightful.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, it's a very warm, welcoming place.
Yep.
We had a drink in the bar. The bar is attractive. But I take the caller's point that I do miss that, you know, the community hub of the plain old theater that families could go to together. This has a liquor license.
And that was reasonably priced.
Exactly. And this has 21 and over. You have to be 21 and over to go. And so it's monetizing that exclusivity.
Yep.
And I get it. That's a business model. And I think they're doing incredibly well. I gather it's an enormously successful theater.
At one time, it was the most successful Cine Bistro location in the country.
That
was about a year ago.
Yeah, and that's great. But I do, I have a soft spot for the beltways of the world, you know, beautifully run theater.
But the economics of it, Christy's point, and Christy, thank you so much for your call, but her point is really well taken. If you're already paying $99 a year for Amazon, you know, or what is it, $12 a month for Netflix or something to stream this stuff, you think, well, why would I then go pay? You know, sometimes it's $50 to go to the movies if you get a bag of popcorn and a Coke and two
parking
tickets.
If you have to park.
You know, So it's tough.
It's no joke.
There are other things, you know, to go to Broadway is $300
right.
sometimes for a junky seat. You know, to go to the Orioles or the Ravens, it's craziness. So inflation may be down, you know,
then you buy Movie Pass. That's a whole other conversation.
Which is like streaming for movie theaters. Yeah, right. We'll talk about that later. But I do want to talk about a couple of movies that are in theaters now. One at the Charles Theater. It's called Isle of Dogs. Mm. This is an animated movie by the great Wes Anderson. So you guys have seen this. What do you think, Chad?
Oh, I loved it. I'm very hot and cold on Wes Anderson. Some of his movies I really have not liked at all. I've walked out of a couple. I thought this was a totally charming, fascinating movie.
Let's listen to a little clip. It's got all sorts of A-list talent in it. Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton, Yoko Ono, Frances McDormand, you name it. Here's a little clip.
I used to sleep on a lamb's wool beanbag next to an electric space heater. That's my territory. I'm an indoor dog.
I starred in 22 consecutive Donkey Chop commercials. Look at me now. I couldn't land an audition.
I was the lead mascot for an undefeated high school baseball team. I lost all my spirit. I'm depressing.
I only ask for what I've always had, a balanced diet, regular grooming, and a general physical once a year.
You're talking like a bunch of housebroken pets.
You don't understand. How could you? You're a...
Go ahead, say it. I'm a stray. Yeah.
All right, the difference between a film and a movie? What's the difference between a dog and a pet, Anne? I don't know. That's interesting.
Yeah, for some reason, I was less beguiled by this than many of my colleagues, including Jed. I found it to be, I mean, the craft of it is superlative.
Yeah,
I mean, you cannot argue with the level of attention and detail that we've come to expect from Wes Anderson. But I didn't think that the story, it's very plotty, and there's lots going on, and it's very digressive and very derivative of other. I mean, it just seems like he's taking influences from so many different things, and that's okay, but it got a little tiresome for me. I wasn't as connected to the story as.
But it is a boy and his dog story. I mean, it's a little boy going to look for his lost dog. I mean, you got me right there. I got to tell you the truth.
And the dogs are fantastic. And
these are all animated dogs.
Yeah. You were giving all that talent. Only their voices are in the movie.
Right,
any of those people.
I actually wanted more of those guys. I mean, they drop out midway through the film, and I really missed them when they were not. I mean, it goes into all these crazy directions and subplots upon subplots. There's a plot involving a character voiced by Greta Gerwig that I also found kind of patronizing and a little problematic culturally. So, yeah, I have a few misgivings about this one.
Fair enough. Wes Anderson, Isle of Dogs. Jed, let's talk about a movie that you have at the Parkway Theater, the home of the Maryland Film Festival. This one called Claire's Camera. This was filmed at Cannes. A couple of years ago. Interesting.
Yeah, it stars Isabelle Huppert. We're about to open this. It's like you said, it was shot sort of during the Cannes Film Festival. And it's one of these charming, smaller movies, I suppose, more independent movies that now are coming to Baltimore. So delighted to have it.
Good for them.
Yeah.
And let's talk about one that you and Jed have both seen called The Death of Stalin.
Oh,
that's at the Charles Theater.
This is a fun one.
Linnell saw it. She liked it.
Oh, this is a blast. I would heartily recommend this one.
Linnell, by the way, listeners, is my wife. She went when I was out of town on a gig.
How dare she?
No, it's all right with her. Girls just got to have fun.
This is by Armando Iannucci, who most people know from Veep. He's the creator of the television show Veep. But he did a fabulous political satire a few years ago called In the Loop.
Oh, indeed.
That was the predecessor to Veep. But he just has a biting, scathing, satirical sense of humor. This is adapted from a graphic novel about the literal few days after Stalin died, when there was a scramble for power amongst Khrushchev and Molotov and Megnikov. And, you know, a lot of those guys from Isle of Dogs are in this one. We have Bob Balaban. Jeffrey Tambor is hilarious.
Steve
Buscemi plays Khrushchev. Yeah. It is, you know, the delicate knife edge this movie had to walk was that there was real political terror going on at this time, and that was no laughing matter at all. And somehow he's managed to create something that's uproariously funny, while in the background, literally, you're watching people going to their deaths. And he doesn't somehow I didn't find it trivializing or offensive. You know, he kind of allows these two things to coexist in a way that it's really difficult, and I think it's brilliant.
I agree with you, and I think this is it's exactly what you just described is what Strangelove did, what Kubrick did with Dr. Strangelove.
That's right.
And I think the ability to show you the ridiculousness of totalitarian government and how it impacts every part of life and how silly it is, along with the brutality, because that's what enforces it. That's what keeps it going. And I think this is just an unbelievably great movie.
Yeah,
Death of Stalin. It's at the Charles Theater here in Baltimore. Talking about movie prices, Jose writes in on email, as a recent retiree in Hagerstown, I discovered the Leitersburg Cinemas that had been bought by a local ad agency and renovated. They renovated Tuesday matinees, $5 tickets for first-run features and $1 for popcorn. So you can't beat it. So good for them in Hagerstown. So the Leitersburg Cinemas, that's a good one. Let's hope that that business model works for those guys. There's a movie called Outside In at the Parkway. Anne, you saw this a while ago, I think. This is about an ex-con trying to readjust to life in a small town. Gotten some good
really
play.
Good.
What
do
you think?
I loved it. It stars Edie Falco and is it Jay or Mark?
Jay
Duplass. And in ways we haven't really seen them before, especially her. And it's written and directed by Lynn Shelton, whom I'm a huge fan of. She did a great movie a few years ago called Hump Day about male friendship. And she just has this she's a really gifted filmmaker, and I'll kick it over to Jed.
Yeah, we had her first film at the festival 2006 or something. I mean, way back. And she's built she's worked very much in independent film. She had Our Sister's Sister, My Sister's Sister, Laggies, working increasingly with more known casts like Edie Falco, but has also built an amazing career directing, what do we call it? Television, streaming, episodic, like Mad Men and The Mindy Project, and she's done a lot of work, so she's got a really wonderful career. This is a old movie story, a guy coming out of prison, and yet it's told, and it's so unexpected as the way it develops, and you don't know what's going to happen. The acting, I think, all across the board is extraordinary and surprising. And it's just a beautifully made movie.
Yeah, it really
is. There's a movie that's opening at the Charles next week, or maybe the very, very beginning of May. I'm not exactly sure when. It's called Beirut.
Oh, yeah.
You guys about this is about a CIA operative in a civil war. And what's this about? And is this a good one?
Yeah, it's really good. Mm. It's John Hamm, speaking of Mad Men, plays the guy, the operative. And it's... written by Tony Gilroy, who wrote and directed my very favorite movie of the 2000s, Michael Clayton. Mm. So, you know, his sensibility is that he really loves those thrillers that we all grew up with. You know, the great golden age of the 1970s, where things were kind of taut and tense, no frills, no fat. He doesn't throw in love interests to make it relatable. You know, it's very tightly focused and extremely well made. Brad Anderson directed it. Mm-hmm. Who I think has been to your festival. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just one of those movies that we say they don't make anymore. It's just a straight ahead, mid-range, adult-oriented thriller. And I really hope people turn out to support it because it's the kind of film we want more of. Mm-hmm. Movie and film.
Yeah, I have a note here that says it opens on May 11th. I don't think that's
we're
right.
Getting
I think
it.
It
I
opens
know DC,
on
we're getting
April
it. Yeah,
11th.
We get it next.
So I think it opens in, if it's opening in D.C. next week, I think it's opening at the Charles
I
Theater
think we're getting
next
it in
weekend.
A week
we'll,
or two.
We'll double check that. But Beirut sounds like a good flick.
Yeah, I agree with everything Ann said. And I love John Hamm and Mad Men, but if you thought that's all he could do, he had no range beyond that, you should see Beirut because he's really, really good in this.
He's very good. It reminded me of The Verdict, you know, because he plays a guy who's been burned, you know, and coming back and against all odds kind of a thing. And he's kind of grizzled and worn down, and it has a very Verdict-y vibe. It's also, you know, in terms of the politics and the actual, you know, the situations that it's bringing to light, it felt to me almost like we're watching the invention of Hamas, even though that name is never really mentioned.
Right.
But it's just in terms of all the competing forces that were brought to bear in Lebanon during that period. There's just it's got
it's
a
good
lot
to see
of content.
An artist like John Hamm, you know, do that kind of thing.
And Rosamund Pike too. She's fantastic.
Yeah,
There's one that's opening at the Parkway on the 13th of April, a week or so. It's called Leaning into the Wind. This is about the artist Andy Goldsworthy. He's a very interesting guy. He does all these installations and stuff. He's an artist. He does installations that are outside and a lot of times like purposely ephemeral, right, Jed?
Yeah, and there was a very well thought of and I thought fascinating documentary several years ago about him called Rivers and Tides. And this is a sort of a sequel, not a term usually used in the documentary world. And he, you know, just as you said, I mean, he's developed beautiful art, I think, to most viewers. But a lot of it is built in a situation outdoors, and so it's just not going to last. And you know, that's a very fascinating thing, not what we think of as in the visual art world. We think of paintings and sculpture that are in museums and stuff or will live forever. And that's not what he does. And we're excited to be showing it. It's a wonderful movie.
All right. So it's Leaning into the Wind. That opens at the Parkway on the 13th. We have now confirmed that Beirut opens at the Charles Theater on April 11th.
Yeah.
So that's
great.
Coming up next week.
Perfect.
And I want to talk about a movie that's directed by a guy who a lot of people know from The Office, the American version of The Office, John Krasinski, who's starred in a bunch of movies as an actor. And he's, you know, obviously done a lot of very famous television. It's called A Quiet place.
Oh, this is amazing. This opens this week. It is fascinating.
And this is at the Charles Theater here in Baltimore, too.
It's a horror thriller. And the premise of the film is that something has happened to draw these creatures to... It takes place in upstate New York, so we don't know how far-ranging it is. But there are these deadly creatures that are blind and sensorily challenged in every way except for their hearing. So if you make the slightest sound, they'll come at you and pounce and eat you alive. So most of this movie happens in silence. And John Krasinski stars along with Emily Blunt, his real-life wife, and they have these children, one of whom is played by Millicent Simmons, who was in the movie Wonderstruck last year and is deaf in real life. Hmm. So they have this deaf daughter who doesn't know. She can't hear what she can't hear, if you know what I mean. So the premise is fascinating, and the purity of the filmmaking, because it really does unfold like a silent film. Wow. With they communicate with ASL, so there's subtitles, but most of it is gestures and facial expressions, and it's not, you know, there is sound and there's music, but it's beautifully done and absolutely exquisitely executed and very effective in terms of the horror elements and the thriller elements. Wow. So I can't recommend it highly enough. I mean, it kind of reminded me of Get Out, which opened around a year, you know, sort of the same time of the year where these people are doing these genre exercises, but really
another sort of early effort as a director, and he goes to the horror genre.
But
it's
very exciting to see these languages coming to bear on these.
Well,
genres.
I see our director Luke Spicknell ferociously taking notes here. I mean, per our discussion at the top of the show, he's saying if there's an animal that kills people who talk too much, I want one. So he's like calling up PetSmart to see if he can get one and bring it into the studio here to get rid of me. All right, that's all the time we have. I very much appreciate. The Maryland Film Festival starts May 2nd, so next time when you guys are here, we will talk about what's happening there and the films that you've chosen. That'll be opening night of the Maryland Film Festival. Right. We look forward to it. Okay, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Jed Dietz is the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. Ann Hornaday, a film critic for the Washington Post and the author of Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. We've got a link to Ann's work in the Post and to what's up at the Parkway Theater, the home of the Maryland Film Festival at wipr.org/midday. Next up, our weekly theater review with J. Wynn Russick. We're going to talk about the new show at the Cohesion Theater. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.